81 degrees and overcast in Midtown Kansas City.
I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For most veterans of the Vietnam War, the effects of the conflict didn't end when they came back home, and for a lot of men, dealing with the war's aftermath was a battle of its own. Today we'll meet a former Marine who knew he wanted to enlist before he was even old enough. By war's end, John Musgrave couldn't help thinking the U.S. was fighting to lose. Before that, though, let's get you ready for holiday wining and dining. We'll reprise a conversation with Master Sommelier Doug Frost and others, chock full of food and drink ideas, sure to make your winter party a hit. Later, Victor Wishna and a Fan's Notes. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. You know, one reason I love the holidays around here is because I get to sit down with two of my favorite people and indulge in a little bit of good wine, some tasty treats, and some great conversation. We're going to talk about how to throw a memorable holiday party, and I don't know why we need our two guests because I'm a master at it myself. Doug Frost is one of our guests today, master of wine and master sommelier. Doug, always good to have you here. Happy holidays to you.
And back at you.
And so is Chef Ted Habiger. He's owner of Room 39 in Westport and out in Leawood. And Ted, happy holidays to you, too.
Thanks for having me.
And our tasters today are two of KCUR's finest, Donald Vestal and Lisa Rodriguez. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Well, what's the most important single ingredient to any successful holiday party? Doug, let me start with you on this.
Friends. I mean, you know, honestly, it's people. Everything that matters, is people. I mean, my ideas about what people should bring to drink or have to drink is based upon what those people are going to want to drink. You know, and if it's soda, great. If it's flavored soda, great. If it's a cocktail or, you know, pre-batched cocktail or wine or beer, what have you, it just matters what your friends and family want to drink, you know?
That's such a pat state answer, Ted. Would you, do you agree with friends or are you going to go somewhere else here?
You know what? That I was like, I'm going to say people. And then he says people, of course.
Oh, yes,
you know,
of course.
It's the truth. I mean, it really is, getting together for any sort of holiday event. If it's family, I think that's great, too, even if you're not friends with your family, because then you really get to know each other better. And that's what the holidays are about, are just kind of celebrating life and enjoying yourself.
Donna, when you throw one of your memorable staff parties, the key ingredient for you is what?
Well, it's always wine.
Wine, yeah. There you go. That gets things going.
Well, it does. It helps me out to relax and, you know, loosen people up. And, you know, I am not the best cook, so I count on the wine to make the difference.
That covers up for all previous sins. Lisa, how about you?
I'm going to have to echo that. And I have to say I choose my holiday parties based on who I know is going to have the best wine and food. No, I'm kidding. It is all about the people, but the wine is a good way to get things started.
Well, Doug, you know, throwing one of these parties, this isn't cheap, right? This is something that needs a little forethought because you're going to invest some bucks.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, because for me, you put out a breadth of flavors, if you will. And by that, I mean, like I said before, there are some people who are going to want to have non-alcoholic drinks. I myself always want to be able to drink a lot of water. As it gets cold, it gets dry, you need to replace that water. And every time you you have a drink of wine or beer, what have you, you really ought to follow it with a drink of water. I mean, it's just the healthful thing to do. And so,
why is that?
Well, you're replacing the diuretic effect of alcohol is such that you're also going to dry yourself out. And
that's one of the reasons. Master of Wine says, the diuretic effect.
He's sounding a lot like my wife.
He's going upstairs here on us.
Well, it's just, it's when people get hangovers. Most of the time, it's because they haven't had enough water. You know, it's like they haven't really had a balanced diet, if you will. All they did was throw some alcohol in their bodies and wonder why they feel bad. You know, you need food, as the Italians always say. They don't say that somebody's had too much to drink. They say, non basta mangiare. They haven't had enough to eat, which makes so much sense. It's about, balancing the food alcohol quotient properly. Mm-hmm. And I'd throw water in that mix as well. So, you're just trying to make sure that you have different flavors. I always think that most people honestly, most people like sweet things. So to have a wine that has some residual sugar to it, whether it's a Moscato or many German Rieslings, not all, but many have some incipient sweetness. And I love that. I think that makes them delicious. I'd always have a wine like that around. Sparkling wine, like we have right now. We've got a little Italian bubbly here.
Yeah, is this right here?
Well, it's not Prosecco. That's what I have to say about this wine.
Yeah.
I'm not done with Prosecco, but it's just like, it seems like all you see anymore when people offer you sparkling wine by the glass is Prosecco. This is an Italian sparkling wine from Trento, but it's not from the Prosecco region. And, to me, I think it's fun to experiment with sparkling wine. They make it all over the place. We make it in Missouri. Le Bourgeois makes a really nice sparkling wine.
Ted, it seems to me, again, I'm no master of wine, but anytime you talk to people about wine and if it carries a little bit of sweetness to it, don't people tend to look down on it a little bit? I mean, isn't there a little bit of an image deal there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, and that's probably our fault in the restaurant business where we want the driest thing out there. And by dry, meaning that it's not very sweet,
right.
It kind of cleans your palate and everything like that. But when, I hate to bring up Prosecco again, but Prosecco does have a touch of sweetness to it at times. And it's one of those things that you start out the day. You're getting ready to go out for dinner and everyone meets and has some salami and has a little bit of Prosecco or some other sparkling and get going.
Lisa Rodriguez, you're not hesitating to imbibe in that glass in front of you there.
You can pour more, Lisa.
Yeah, in fact, you're going through it, and I'm wondering what you think of it.
Oh, I love it. I hear Prosecco and of course I do think it has a little sweetness, and we did make clear this is not Prosecco, and I don't think that it's it's nice and dry. It's got a little, a little fruit to it as well, but not too much, and I like it.
Yeah,
no
Donna,
complaints here. I love the non Prosecco.
Donna, your critique, which is what everyone's waiting for here, the final word.
Well, I love how crisp it is. Actually, it feels crisp to me in a way that most sweet wines I don't necessarily get, or I don't know. Is that the right way to describe
it? No, I think
that?
that's a perfect way to put it. A sparkling wine like this has sort of a yeasty, biscuity flavor as well. And this Giulio Ferrari, I think it's a fun wine. Even though it's not champagne, it has some similarity.
What region is it from?
This is Trento in northern
Trento.
Italy.
Trento, okay. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about how to throw a good holiday party with Chef Ted Haberger of Room 39, Master of Wine Doug Frost, Lisa Rodriguez, Donna Vestal, both from KCUR here. We're all having a good time, and I think at this point in the show, we probably should invite everyone listening in the greater Kansas City area to come on down to 4825 Truesden and take part. This is such a nice time.
Let's get this party started.
Let's get it going, yeah. Let's go. What do we have coming up here next, Doug? You have a new glass of wine you're pouring folks here. What is it?
This is Brian Carter's Oriana. It's a blend of Viognier, Roussan, and a little tiny bit of Riesling. It's Washington State. We went from Italy to Washington State, and indeed, this is just an aromatic, almost sort of floral white wine with a lot of density to it, kind of the opposite of what you would expect from the nose, because the nose smells kind of floral and pretty, and then you taste it and it has almost the weight of a Chardonnay. So it's kind of a wacky wine. I just think it's a fun wine. And back to your question, Steve, about how much it's supposed to cost.
Yes.
This wine's up in the 30s, and the sparkling wine we just had, that's close to that price as well. But in truth, you ought to be able to buy a nice bottle of wine for 10 or 12 bucks.
Mm-hmm.
And
you said that for a long time.
Yeah.
You championed that cause.
Yeah. It's it's so funny because I go to sometimes these really nice meals where people are like, well, I don't know if I should have you choose the wine. You're probably going to pick something really expensive. And I always get my nose out of joint a little bit about that, because after everything I've studied and all the time I've spent in the business, if I can't find the cheap, great wine, what the heck is that information good for?
Right.
I mean, anybody can buy the expensive wine. It's finding that little gem, that's on a wine list for 32 bucks. It's really fun.
Ted, you've just served up your first little tasty treat here. Tell us about it, because it was good.
Well, this is just an appetizer I feel like you could do for a lot of parties. This is a KC shrimp ceviche.
Ah.
So there's a great little new company that's in Blue Springs that makes shrimp. Okay, so it's farm-raised shrimp. It's delicious. It's super fresh. I just chopped it up, mixed it with lime juice, and then lots of local root vegetables. So I took turmeric, a little bit of local ginger, some kohlrabi, all from some from Prairie Birthday Farm, some from Crumb's Farm out in Bonner Springs, a little bit of orange, and some cilantro on top. that's the dish.
Voila.
Right? Oh, and it's on a little red pepper lavash there. That's what that is.
Yeah. Well, Lisa Rodriguez, Donna Vestal are, I think the word is eagerly taste sampling this new treat from Ted.
That was a polite way to put it. Inhaling
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Maybe better. It really is delicious and super fresh. And it's what's nice that, you know, I take a bite, I enjoy all the flavors, and then they're gone. So that's why I immediately need to go back for another bite. It's really, really nice.
Donna?
Well, I do think I could actually make this from the way that you described it. So that's a big plus. So I think I'll try that. It's wonderful. Of course it is. I have a little bit different crackers because I'm gluten-free.
Yeah.
But it's great on there. And alone, even without the cracker. Really good. Yeah.
Doug Frost, anything else that folks might want to think about when it comes to getting a handle on some of the big cost drivers of any holiday party that might be coming up?
Yeah, I think probably the single most important thing when people are trying to figure out how it is that they would find good wines, you know, waiting for people like me to review a particular wine or trying to find a 98-point wine or what have you, I think is kind of silly. It's counterproductive because the most direct way to find good wine is to have a relationship with a retailer who knows what you like and that you can, you know, I mean, it's the old Cheers thing that they can, you know, you walk in the door and you can go, remember me, you sold me this, you sold me that. And they're like, yeah, what'd you like? Well, I like this better than that. And they're like, okay, let me show you this, this, and that.
Yeah.
It really is that, you know, retailers have hundreds, if not thousands, of wines to choose from. And walking in the door saying, I need just this wine because, you know, Doug gave it a great review, I think it's just counterproductive when that retailer may or may not have the wine, but if they know your preference, then they can show you stuff that you will like. Now, you know, as I say, I feel the same way about the whole party idea that I need to have, you know, a wine that has some sweetness to it. I need to have some bubbly. I need to have a soft red. I need to have a big, powerful red wine, maybe a Chardonnay. And maybe one bottle of each is plenty. It just depends upon how many people are coming over.
Now, we've talked about this many times. Lisa, Donna, I'd be curious to get your take on this. But this notion that the wine industry writ large is just sort of shrouded in mystery. You know, consumers just don't know where to go, what to buy, how much to spend. The mystery seems to endure year after year.
Well, I know that's true, but I'm heartened by this idea that I could maybe talk to that retailer or someone about that $10 to $12 price range, because that's really what I want to focus on. But I feel guilty when I go into a wine store and I talk about that. So
yes.
I'm just very hesitant because I feel like if I'm going to talk to them for advice, I should buy a much more expensive bottle of wine. And that's just not practical. That doesn't get me through week to week.
Doug, your point is if Donna's not comfortable, maybe that's not a store she should shop in.
Yeah,
because she should be comfortable going into that store and having that conversation.
I really feel that way. And you know, it's interesting. Right now, the hot spot in terms of retail is $12 to $15 a bottle. That's where most everybody's spending their money. So if you walk in and say, I'd rather not spend anything over $15, but I'm looking for a red like this, a white like this, you know, I like this wine, that'll give them all the information they need. And if they don't, you know, jump at the chance to show you some fun stuff, then it's maybe time to find a different store.
Lisa, you've worked in the restaurant industry and have always been impressed. You seem to understand this at a level that I never will. But how do you navigate the whole business of buying wine?
I've developed, you know, what I know that I like. And I also tend to go to the same stores over and over again and buy from the same people. And so I always want to try something new. I never want to go and get the same bottle all the time because I know that's what I like. And I have fallen into that before. But like Doug said, having that connection with someone's like, hey, you know, I like this. Give me something new. Give me something that I've never had before. Or never heard of.
Well, we're also joined here by Keith Thompson, co-owner of Brewery Imperial, a new brewery that's just sprung up in town. Ted's a co-owner as well. And tell us about it, Ted.
Oh, gosh. This is a project that's been in the work for about almost 2 years. Well, in Keith's mind, for 10 years. But I joined it a couple years ago. We're at 19th and Oak. And it's a brewery and restaurant that will feature a live fire. We'll be cooking over fire there and lots of great beers.
Keith, how'd you get involved in a brewery of all things?
I've been brewing for a long time. Started in college at Free State and then came to Kansas City and worked at a few breweries here. And it just became one of those things where it was time to do something on my own. So
if Free State's on your resume, then you come highly recommended.
I think that's pretty good.
Ted, you've served up your second dish here. It's got a raw egg sort of splashed over the top of it. Tell us about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a root vegetable hash. So there's everything from sweet potato in there. I've got a little Brussels sprouts, butternut squash, some mushrooms from from there's a guy in the West Bottoms that grows mushrooms. And delivers them to restaurants.
You just know all these guys.
I know,
don't you? You
do,
know the
right?
guys. Yeah,
that's the best thing about my job. I think is just those people that are these artisan producers that make all these different things.
That's great.
And then I just did a soft boiled egg right on top.
Soft boiled, not raw. My bad. Lisa, I've never tasted hash like this before. Are you in the same boat as I am here?
It's delicious. I feel like with every bite, I taste something different in here. And I love any dish that has, as you so eloquently put, raw egg splashed on top of it.
Put an egg on it.
Put an egg on it.
Everybody's putting an egg right these days.
Exactly.
You know?
I'm firmly in that camp.
Yeah. Donna, what do you think?
Well, I love eggs, so that's... But I'm not sure I could make this one. The presentation was so gorgeous on our plates. I
These
know you
incredible.
All can't see it. It just looks as good as it tastes. So
it's very simple, really. I mean, it is just about vegetables and about cooking them to the right temperature.
Cooking them to the perfect place.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's easy. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Doug Frost, you've had a chance to sample some Kolscher from Brewery Imperial. Tell me about it. What do you make of it?
Well, you know, the Kolsch style, it goes back to Köln or Cologne in Germany, and it's a kind of a sort of in-betweeny, if you will, because it's an ale, but it also gets lagered a little bit. And, you know, it's a – I think as a Kolsch style, you know, I don't pretend to be a beer expert whatsoever. I spent my life around wine and spirits and cocktails, but I drink a lot of beer because it takes a lot of beer to enjoy wine, I think, ultimately, and really to read about it and stuff like that. And I think this is a good telling of the Kolsch style for sure.
Well, this is always – we've reached the point in the show when we do these holiday gatherings where your host has to sort of put the brakes on because he's having a great time. We got to be a little bit careful here. You know, I was thinking a little bit about our conversations about, you know, throwing a party. You know, the old standards when it comes to winter holiday gatherings are what, you know, Doug? I mean, what do you definitely need to have on hand if you're throwing a big holiday party?
Well, I think sparkling wine is always important. It just really gives that festive, you know, view. And you can make sparkling cocktails. You can use sparkling wine in cocktails in place of sparkling water. You can do all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, there need to be bubbles about. And it just makes people happy. It really does. And I certainly
think... You can really tell a difference. The bubbles pick up spirits, you're saying.
Yeah, they really do. You know, there's something probably primal about it. I'm not really sure why it should be so. It's not like the primal, you know, feeling you get from a fire. But the minute we hear that pop, if you will, the minute we see the bubbles coming up in the glass, the minute you get that funny texture, the you know, fizzy thing going on in your mouth, everybody just starts grinning. And so I think, you know, you need that. But I think that the idea is to have something that appeals to everybody. I try to have a cross-section, whether I have, you know, light beers and heavy beers, and whether I have, you know, a punch sort of prepared, some kind of punch ready to go so I can give somebody a sweet or slightly sweet and spicy cocktail. And certainly red wine, white wine, something sweet, something dry.
You know, Ted, this notion that people's spirits pick up when a bottle is popped and the bubbles come out, have you noticed the same kind of thing at your restaurants?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, there is something so celebratory about champagne or sparkling wine. I mean, people really want to celebrate, and it's a good time to drink it.
Keith, why beer in your world as opposed to, you know, making wine? Why the interest in beer?
I think it's very sustainable as for me drinking it. I like to have a few, so itself regulates, and the what I like about it is also how it crosses borders with wine. Sometimes you're talking about bubbles and carbonation. You know, there's similarities there. I guess I get as excited when the cap comes off a bottle of beer as I do when a cork comes out of a bottle of sparkling.
You're very democratic that way, it sounds like. Yeah, I like that, yeah. You know, Doug, you've talked about buying wine as a gift, and you called wine a very practical gift. Why is that?
Well, because even if those people don't necessarily want that bottle, it's an easy thing to re-gift. Nobody hates being re-gifted a bottle of wine. I mean, it's like, really, you know?
Yeah.
And then my other advice, of course, as I think I've said before, if you can get a label that's in a foreign language, and if you can make sure it has some obscurity to it in some way, more mysterious, the harder to read, the better. That really makes people think you've spent a fortune.
Yeah.
It works.
We're getting some very practical advice today on holiday parties and holiday food and drink from Master of Wine Doug Frost, Chef Ted Habiger of Room 39, Lisa Rodriguez, Donna Vestal, both from KCUR with us here. Doug, you wrote about your trip to Havana and you said this, and I love this line, Doug. Havana, you said, moves, but it thrums rather than throbs. What an interesting line. And you also wrote, I know of no city like it. Tell about a city that thrums rather than throbs.
Well, it just has this, you know, this rhythm to it.
Yeah.
And it, not surprisingly, that is... most cities sort of assault you. Most cities are so loud and noisy that they attack you. And this city instead seems to have its own rhythm that you can kind of jump into or not if you want to. It, you know, it's on the surface. And people are incredibly friendly, incredibly nice and welcoming to you. Even if it's a busy, loud city at times, nobody seems to hesitate to answer a question or help you out.
You got to tell us about the rum.
Oh, yeah, God. I really believe in Cuban rum as an article of, you know, one of those great styles, one of the standards, really. Rums are all different types. Rum is almost like saying, you know, booze, because there's so many different kinds. But Cuban rum was reinvented post-revolution, and it was taken, I think the intention was to make great Cuban rum, as it always was. But I think, in effect, what happened was they made Cuban rum an older, more elaborate process, and a more thrilling drink, because there's more layers to it, because there are older rums in it than there used to be. It used to be a relatively light style.
Yeah. You've poured one final glass of wine here for us this morning, and what can you say about it?
Well, I love Oregon Pinot Noir. This is Elk Cove. I love those guys. I think they make fantastic Pinot Noir. I know that Pinot Noir is still kind of in the headlines, even years after a silly movie was made about it. But I still drink this stuff, and I still like this stuff. It was kind of my first love when it comes to wine. And I think Elk Cove makes a delicious Pinot Noir.
We're following the Riesling here, so it's going to be drier, I'm guessing. Donna, tell us about your reaction to it.
Well, I'm definitely more of a white wine drinker, so it's fine. But it's not my love.
It's outside your comfort zone
it's
here a little
yes.
bit.
Fine.
Yeah, okay. Lisa?
Oh, I love Pinot Noir, and I think this is a bottle that I could bring to a party and know that anyone there who drinks red wine is gonna love this wine. Mm. And I like it. I love the dryness to it, and I'm with Doug. I love an Oregon Pinot Noir. It's a place I'm comfortable trying new bottles within a same region.
Yeah. Yeah. Ted, you just gave it a whirl here, too. What do you think?
Oh, the way to my heart is through Pinot Noir, pretty much. It always has been. And
what do you like about it so much?
Well, you know, I often think of Pinot Noir as kind of the white wine of the red wines. You know, like it's a little bit of that cross. You know, it's got the great acidity of white wine and all those kind of floral components. But then it also has like that kind of mushroomy and thick red tannin thing that can happen. Mm-hmm. You know,
how is the wine business just in general these days, Doug? What are we seeing as the economy picks up and people are maybe feeling a little better about things?
Increased growth. It has stalled a little bit over the last couple of years, but we're seeing some upticks again. The main driver really in the wine business has been if the numbers aren't the volume numbers aren't going up precipitously, and they're not. They've kind of stalled out at that. People are spending more money on wine, so that the dollars continue to go up at a pretty good pace. And as I say, I mean, even if you go back to the long recession or near the end of it, I guess, people were looking at $10 to $12 bottles of wine at most. Now it's that $12 to $15 price point. And that doesn't sound like a big change, but you take that times the millions of bottles that people are buying. And it really has a big impact on the industry.
Is there one wine that's sort of a hot product right now? Is something in vogue, maybe more so than the last recent years?
Actually, interestingly, no. I mean, this is, I think, the most interesting part about the wine business is where once upon a time we talked about Pinot Noir being the hot thing or Pinot Grigio being the hot thing. Even, you know, Chardonnay going back 10 years ago, it's still the number one white wine out there. What has happened is that people are parcelating their interests, just like we see in any other industry. And I think it's increased information that we have available to us. Now people will try Albarino or Grunewaldliner, or they'll try a dry Riesling from Australia. There's just a million different options out there, and people actually pursue them. So that's the great change. If there's a single category that's doing well, it's the red blend. It's the idea that people will just put different grapes together and say, this is a nice blend, much like that white blend that we had at the outset.
What are people asking for in the restaurant these days, Ted?
Well, you know, I have to agree. It's completely changing, you know, and we did go through this period for the last couple of years where craft cocktails were what everybody wanted. And I saw cocktail sales just go through the roof, and wine has made a comeback in the last 6 months, and it's great to see. And people want to try different grape varieties.
Yeah. Sounds good. Folks, we're out of time. I want to thank Doug Frost again for coming in. Doug, it's always happy times when you're here. So always good
thank
to hear
you so much, Steve. And happy holidays to you.
You bet. Our holiday party conversation first aired in December last year. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with John Musgrave, one of the veterans featured in the PBS documentary, The Vietnam War. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. John Musgrave is a Marine who served in Vietnam. More recently, he was featured in the Ken Burns, Lynn Novick PBS production on Vietnam, which placed him in the national spotlight. The Independence native, who now lives in Baldwin City, Kansas, told a series of riveting stories in the series, including the night he was so close to the enemy that he could hear them whispering. That experience is why Musgrave, even now, keeps a light glowing in his bedroom at night. John Musgrave joins us now, and John, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about that night when you were so close to the North Vietnamese that you could actually hear them whispering.
I was terrified. I really don't have the language that adequately describes how terrified I was.
Mm-hmm.
There were three of us with a radio that we couldn't talk on. And there were men looking for us that wanted to kill us.
Hmm.
And we were holding, each one of us was holding a hand grenade. Because if we knew if we fired our rifles, they'd know where we were because of the muzzle flash.
Right, right.
So we did a lot of praying.
Once daybreak came, how did you make your escape?
They had moved on.
Mm-hmm.
And got our gear together and got out of there as quickly as we could, and that's an understatement.
I bet you can hear those whispered voices even today.
I suspect that's the dreams that I have that wake me up screaming. I never remember them, but I suspect that that might be it, because that was one of the most terrifying experiences I ever had.
This idea that you have a nightlight now on in your room at night, from that night, is that what the genesis of that was?
From that night and a lot of other nights.
The
night belonged to the North Vietnamese.
You've talked about this idea that the North Vietnamese would wait, John, until U.S. troops would be right on top of them before they would spring up and surprise the Americans. What a terrifying idea that is to me.
It was terrifying to experience it.
Yeah.
Their slogan was, when you fight the Americans, hang on to their belts.
Meaning?
That you don't make contact until we were very close to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so we couldn't call in airstrikes without calling them in on ourselves. And sometime it came to that.
And that's what happened to you when you were shot, right? Shot,
yes.
And grievously wounded.
Yes.
You were shot from like 10 feet away.
Yeah, we were very close.
Yeah. What happened that day?
We got sucked into an ambush. We had a new lieutenant and a new captain.
Mm-hmm.
And the North Vietnamese dangled the bait out there for us, which was three North Vietnamese soldiers firing their AKs on full automatic, not caring if they hit anything, and then they would run on into the brush.
Mm-hmm.
They got us into thick jungle. And then they popped the ambush on us. I was one of the first people to be shot, so I don't know a whole lot of what took place.
Right.
I'd been wounded before, but I'd never been shot. And getting shot is a lot more personal, and it hurts more than anything I've ever experienced in my life. And I knew I was dying.
I was going to say, did you think that was it?
I knew it was. I had a fist-sized hole in my chest. We were in a terrible fight. At least one man had already been killed trying to rescue me.
Hmm.
And at least one other one had already been wounded. I had seen men, I'd been in country 11 and a half months, so I'd seen men wounded like that, and I knew what my chances were. And so I told my buddies to leave me and prayed for my family.
Mm-hmm. The fact that you're here today, all these years later, you've appeared in the series, that must be something of a miracle for you.
It is, and I owe it all to the valor of the young men I served with.
Mm-hmm.
They refused to leave me at great peril to themselves as they drugged me out of the jungle. The North Vietnamese were pursuing us, and they would drop me and lay down on top of me, covered me with their bodies, and they knew I was dying.
Mm-hmm.
But they did that for me and for the grenadier in my squad. They were willing to die to try to get us out. Marines never leave their wounded.
Yeah. Which is one of the remarkable things about the Marines, right?
Amen.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I'm alive. I was rescued twice under fire. And I am forever grateful for their valor and for the tradition that made that possible.
Vietnam vet and Marine John Musgrave is my guest. How did Ken Burns and Lynn Novick find you to turn you into this international TV star through the Vietnam War series?
I was working with the 1st Infantry Division at Fort Riley on post-traumatic stress education, and I was also asked to help with a program called Theater of War, established by Brian Dorries out of New York, where they do ancient Greek plays
right
on military bases and hospitals all over the world. It's extraordinary. His wife was Sarah Botstein, who was one of the directors of the documentary, and he told me that Ken Burns and Lynn Novick were doing a documentary on Vietnam, and I thought, oh, thank God, this is finally, I knew the story would be told without a political axe to grind.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked if he could give them my contact information, and I said, yeah, right, sure, go ahead. Didn't expect anything to come from it. I was speaking at an Armed Forces conference for a Defense Department conference at Norfolk, Virginia, on post-traumatic stress. My presentation was on PTSD. And Lynn Novick called me and said, I'd like to fly down and have breakfast with you tomorrow, and would that be all right? I said, sure. We had a wonderful breakfast. She's an extraordinary person.
Yeah, we've had her on the show.
Yeah. Oh, great.
Yeah.
Great, then you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And I walked out of there thinking that my job was going to be to find incredible veterans for them to speak to, because sure, I know a lot of incredible vets whose stories have never been told, and America needs to hear their stories. So I was really surprised when they called with an invitation to fly to New York City and interviewed me there, and I thought, boy, you know, if I get a minute in a Ken Burns documentary, that's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew it would be just such a wonderful honor. And
right.
I never expected in my wildest dreams to have as large a role in it as I did.
Have you had a lot of your old comrades, your old buddies reaching out to you in the wake of that?
So far, only one.
Huh.
I got to understand that the unit that I served with, 1st Battalion, 9th Marines of the 3rd Marine Division, while we were in Vietnam, we suffered the highest casualties of any Marine infantry battalion in the history of the Marine Corps.
Hmm.
And we've been fighting wars for 242 years.
Yeah.
So only one so far. I look forward to any others getting in touch with me. I'm hearing from veterans literally all over the world.
What are they saying to you, John?
With the exception, I've had one exception, one guy calling me a traitor and trying to stir up public indignation against me.
Right.
And everybody else has been extraordinarily kind. I've heard from Israeli veterans. I've heard it's just showed in England, so I'm getting a lot of emails down from England. I heard from somebody in Norway who had been a friend of my first company commander before mm-hmm. he was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Both of my company commanders were killed in action. So I've heard from people in from France, Scandinavia.
And are people telling you their own stories?
Yes.
I bet.
Yes, a lot of them are telling me what it was like. Even people from Europe and Australia are telling me what it was. The war was like for them.
Mm-hmm.
That if they're my age, the war, even though their country wasn't involved, save for the French at that point, they were still involved in the youth movement that war really sparked.
Right, right.
And they always have stories to tell me about their experience while I was in country. And if they were too young to be in the war, they tell me what they knew and what they learned from the documentary.
Yeah.
And all of them, everyone, even Vietnam combat veterans have told me, I've learned so much watching this documentary.
You've said you've learned a lot watching
Absolutely.
The documentary.
Absolutely.
And
right.
you had been a student of this war in
yes.
the years since. What surprised you by what Ken and Lynn came up with?
Well, they had access to information that that I had never seen nor heard.
Such as?
What was going on behind the scenes in the White House with each succeeding administration. My bitterness over the lack of concern for our safety,
right.
for our futures, exhibited especially by the Nixon administration, it just infuriates me.
They didn't know what they were doing. That's one of the conclusions you've drawn, I think, from watching this and from your
Nixon own. Nixon and Kissinger knew exactly what they were doing. Johnson, I think, was just stepped into the quicksand with his eyes on an ideal that he wasn't comfortable with. He didn't feel like it was his war. And this is the impression that I get from the documentary. But I think he got in and couldn't figure out how to get out. Nixon knew exactly how to get out and just didn't do it.
Because
he wanted to be reelected for a second term.
Mm-hmm.
More Americans died during Nixon's withdrawal than during Johnson's buildup.
Hmm.
Most Americans don't realize that.
How do you manage your bitterness, to use your word, in the wake of this and the way American leadership navigated this war?
By talking to the American people as often as I can and as honestly as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about my bitterness over the draft. It targeted the working class and poor while letting the middle class and the upper class get a pass with college deferments.
And you were an example of that as a kid from Independence, right?
I could have been, but I was going to join the Marine Corps whether there was a war or not, whether there was a draft or not. I wanted to be in the Marine Corps. But my buddies, the guys I served with, had they been given a choice, they would have preferred to have stayed at home. They were not all as motivated as I was for a shortcut to manhood. And I was just eager to taste the glories of war.
Where did that come from in your life, John?
From the movies I grew up watching
hmm.
and the books I grew up reading. You've got to understand that my generation on Friday night and Saturday night, when we could stay up late, we're watching the movies that were made during the Second World War and just after the Second World War. That's what was showing on television for us. And that's where a lot of us got our idea about war was like.
Hmm.
Needless to say, I was not prepared for the reality that I was immersed in when I was first involved in combat.
Describe that reality to us. What did you see, and what took you so aback?
I remember being amazed that even a Marine could be terrified. And I was eager to meet the enemy and to kill them. All my heroes growing up, my cowboy heroes killed people, my my police heroes on TV killed people, and my secret agent heroes, you know, Sean Connery, James Bond, the coolest guy in the world, and he had a license to kill. And even the cool bad guys, they killed people. I probably watched a couple of 100,000 people kill people before I enlisted. But when confronted with the reality of killing another human being, I just had no idea what that was going to be like.
Because it was so hard for you.
It was terrible. It was my first experience with killing someone was very, very intimate. And it wasn't what I thought. I thought I was going to feel good about it, and I thought I was going to feel like a man, and I didn't. I was sick, and I just wanted to go home. And that's when I made my deal with the devil.
Which was?
I swore 3 days later, or 2 days later, I saw my first Marine die. And he was a man that had been nice to me and supportive. He stepped on a bouncing Betty mine. That's a horrible way to die. And I swore at that point that I would never kill another human being. However, I would waste every gook I found. Hmm. We didn't even say we killed him. I turned subjects into objects.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get teenage Eagle Scouts and young Christians to become effective killers. And it never bothered me again.
Hmm. Even in the years since, you describe watching the Vietnam series on PBS as maybe for the first time seeing the humanity in the enemy that
Absolutely.
You had faced. And that was something that maybe you hadn't expected going into that series?
I didn't expect the impact it was going to have on me. Seeing them as old men, that really... that helped me, because in my nightmares, they're always young and vital and terrifying. You know, that word keeps coming up, I know, but I lived with terror. And it was just extraordinary to relate to them as old men like myself. And I discovered myself viewing them as fellow combat veterans that I would be honored to sit down and talk to.
Yeah.
I'd written a poem many years ago about acknowledging the humanity of the man who shot me. And that was esoteric, you know. But the reality of seeing them and talking about their fear and their hatred, that just... humanize them for me.
Yeah, I've got to go in about 30 seconds, you know, it's interesting that that word terrifying, I still don't associate that word oftentimes with soldiers, and yet you've used it here several times this morning.
That's combat.
That's what it is.
Yes.
Yeah. John Musgrave, a Marine who served in the Vietnam War, he was featured in the Ken Burns, Lynn Novak PBS production on Vietnam. What a pleasure to have you here.
It was a privilege.
I should point out, you have a book of poetry out that it offers all kinds of insights. I've read several of them into what your experience was and continues to be even to this day.
My Such biography great stuff. Comes out around the first of the year.
Are you writing it?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm working with another author. Yes.
I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I'd be honored.
John Musgrave, thanks very much. Fans know that their favorite teams are full of drama, on the field and sometimes off. Players come and players go. But at every game, there's at least one real character whose only job is to be a good sport. Commentator Victor Wishna explains in this month's edition of A Fan's Notes.
Hey, who says there's no good news anymore? You may have missed this, but just last week, the Kansas City Royals' own slugger, you know, the 6'9" lion who dances on the dugout between innings, was inducted into the National Mascot Hall of Fame. Yeah, that's really a thing. And as of next year, it will be a place. A new 25,000-square-foot multi-million-dollar hall will open in Whiting, Indiana, 20 minutes outside of Chicago. Slugger joins an elite group. Out of an estimated 5,000 costumed mascots in American pro and college sports, less than 24 have made it into the hall, voted in because they, quote, demonstrate a major impact on their sport and or community. Besides every Royals home game, Slugger makes about 500 appearances each year, including the strikeout bullying campaign he brings to local schools. Nice to know we can still look to sports for compelling examples of character. Yes, mascots seem silly. By design, sure, but also as a concept that has its roots in superstition, something fans know well, and that dates back more than a century. The word mascot itself derives from the French term for magic charm. Early teams such as baseball's St. Louis Browns would adopt dogs and boys that they believed brought them good luck. In 1908, the Chicago Cubs introduced a small taxidermy bear. Did I say silly? I meant creepy. And later replaced it with the real living thing, a practice that continues for a number of teams. But mascots as we really know them today, that is, adult humans sweating under pounds of colorful foam and felt, began in the 1960s. Which came first? The chicken. The San Diego chicken, of course, whose antics drew huge crowds at Padres games and inspired the Philly fanatic. Both would be recognized as charter inductees of the Hall of Fame. They perfected the mascot mystique, dancing, prancing, pranking opponents, entertaining the kiddos, and launching hot dogs and T-shirts into the stands. Since then, there's really been no limit to just how far teams, particularly college teams, will go. It ain't just Tigers and Wildcats, or for that matter, Jayhawks or Kangaroos. There's Hokies and Hoyas and Horned Frogs, yet even the infamous Stanford Tree or Sammy the Banana Slug of UC Santa Cruz has got nothing on the Fighting Okra of Division II Delta State in Mississippi. And sports teams are hardly the only institutions with mascots. From countries to military units to corporate brands, there is a need to forge identity through symbols that represent strength or resilience or just good humor. Of course, sometimes, too often, mascots have crossed the line from archetype to stereotype. Our Kansas City Chiefs have come under pressure to change their name. I'd sure support them if they did. Thankfully, they ditched the white guy in a headdress, riding war paint, in favor of the cuddly, cartoonish KC Wolf, who, by the way, was the first NFL mascot inducted into the Hall back in 2006. The best mascots are among the game's most valuable players. They take that sense of loyalty, unity, and belonging that sports is supposed to engender and humanize it. Okay, humanize may not be the right word, but they certainly connect with fans. Just consider the statement that a grateful slugger himself issued after the announcement via the Royals media department. I take a lot of pride in being one of the main attractions at Kauffman Stadium. I'd be lying if I said this wasn't one of my proudest moments as the official mascot of the Kansas City Royals. With all the fretting over free agency, we don't know which fan favorites will still be around come spring training. But one thing is sure, every time we go to the park, we'll see a real Hall of Famer.
To me, he's a fabulous character. He's all.
Victor Wishin is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. What's more?